I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. A special edition of our program today as we prepare to go to NPR's live coverage this hour of the news conference in Paris with President Donald Trump and French President Emmanuel Macron. Trump is sure to face questions about Russia and its meddling in the 2016 presidential election. He has been largely out of the public eye since the release of his eldest son's now famous emails. The scope of Russia investigations in the House, the Senate, and with the special counsel continues to expand. We'll begin this hour with the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Will England. He's an editor on the Washington Post Foreign Desk who oversees the paper's Russia coverage and the author of a book on Russia called March 1917, On the Brink of War and Revolution. Coverage of the presidential news conference begins right after these headlines. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us for this special edition of Midday. Today, we had planned to bring you the July installment of Living Questions, our series on religion in the public sphere. We will bring you that conversation next Thursday here on Midday. Also, we will bring you theater critic J. Wynn Russick's review of the Contemporary American Theater Festival tomorrow after the Midday news wrap. So coming up in this hour, we will bring you NPR's live coverage of a press conference with President Donald Trump and President Emmanuel Macron of France. That is scheduled to get underway in about 15 minutes or so, and we will bring you that press conference in its entirety. So before we begin our preview of that press conference taking place in Paris, this reminder that the Baltimore City Health Department has issued its first code red heat advisory today. It is in effect now. It is currently 94 degrees here in Baltimore, and it's projected to go up to as high as 96 or even 98 degrees a little later in the day. So be careful. Make sure you're drinking plenty of fluids. If you know somebody, particularly elderly people or young people, little kids, keep an eye on them. Try to stay inside in air conditioning if you can. Remember, never leave children or pets in a locked car or a car with the windows up, even for a brief period of time. So code red heat advisory in effect today. Now, President Trump has been invited for a state visit to Paris. He left Washington last night. They're going to celebrate Bastille Day tomorrow and the 100th anniversary of America's entrance into World War I. Joining me now is Will England. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner who has had three tours as a Moscow correspondent for both the Washington Post and the Baltimore Sun. He's currently a foreign editor at the Washington Post. He directs the Post's Russia coverage. He's also the author of a great book about Russia called March 1917, On the Brink of War and Revolution. He joins us from the newsroom of the Washington Post. Will, thanks for your time today.
Sure thing. Hi, Tom.
So this is a fairly relatively quick trip. He's the president arrived in Paris this morning and will be leaving Saturday morning, I guess, or Friday night, actually, coming back to Washington. Somewhat hastily arranged. Jenna Johnson, our friend and your colleague at the Post, wrote a piece today that said that once President Macron promised Mr. Trump that he could attend a military parade, he was convinced that this was a trip worth taking, even though he has just seen Mr. Macron at the G20 summit just a week or so ago. What do you make of the fact that the president has accepted this invitation to come to Paris and that Macron extended the invitation in the first place?
Well, Macron is, you know, he's an interesting character. You remember that he had Putin as a guest, President Putin of Russia as a guest last month and, you know, gave him a stern talking to about Russian media. I don't think we're going to see the same thing with when he, you know, deals with Trump today and tomorrow, but you never know. Trump likes spectacle, and if there's one thing that the French can do on Bastille Day, it's spectacle.
You know, there's a headline in a Reuters story this morning that I had to chuckle at. It says, Trump, escaping domestic troubles, visits France's Macron. And I wonder if, in fact, he is, just because he's in Paris, he's, in fact, going to be able to escape his domestic troubles. What do you think? I mean, obviously, he's going to be giving one of his first press conferences this afternoon in a while. He did give a sit down for an interview with Reuters, and there was an interview that he gave with the Christian Broadcasting Network in the last couple of days. But at this press conference, obviously, Russia and the Russian investigation into meddling in the 2016 presidential election is going to be high on reporters' agendas to talk to the president about. In your view, what are the most important questions we should have for the president concerning Russia?
The most important questions for the president concerning Russia would be if he could perhaps explain why he has been so supportive of Russia ever since approximately June of 2016, why his people made such an effort to put the line in the Republican Party platform last summer that took a line out in support of Ukraine. Another question would be, what other meetings did his people have with Russians as he was campaigning for president and after he was elected president that we haven't heard about yet?
And do you see any sign on the horizon that the president's posture towards Russia will change now that we've had this revelation made by Mr. Trump's son himself, Donald Trump Jr., when he released this chain of emails on Tuesday in advance of the New York Times reporting on it? These emails, of course, were the precursor to a meeting that eventually took place with a woman named Natalia Veselnitskaya, who is a lawyer with alleged ties to the Kremlin. I mean, do you see any indication that the Trump White House is going to be changing its posture, changing its strategy, if you will, in terms of how they're handling the mounting questions about this?
Well, I think in one sense, we've already been seeing the White House change its position on Russia because Russia has just become so toxic in American politics. If Trump had the idea of lifting sanctions against Russia, which was what this Russian lawyer who was in that meeting a year ago was angling for, there's no way he could do that now. If he wanted to give Russia a free hand in Ukraine, there's no way he could do that now. Will he be dealing with the sort of Russia scandal, if I can put it that way, differently? To my mind, he has to. He's been, denouncing it as fake news and a witch hunt, and I think these latest revelations would make that harder to continue with that argument. But on the other hand, this is Donald Trump, and he may decide that, he'll double down.
You covered Russia for a long time. You're directing the Post's coverage of Russia as we speak. What can you tell us about Natalia Veselnitskaya, this attorney who requested the meeting with Donald Trump Jr.? And the meeting was something that at least initially before it happened, Mr. Trump Jr. was quite excited about it, using the term "I'd love it" to respond to the notion that Ms. Veselnitskaya had some information that was damaging to the Clinton campaign.
To me, it's just the most fascinating story. Her background is as a very successful lawyer in land development issues, we could call them land disputes in the Moscow region, which is the sort of like vaguely equivalent to the state that surrounds Moscow but does not include the city itself. And there's been, as you might suppose, considerable amount of land speculation in this part of the world in the last 15 years. She's been at the heart of it. She has her husband is a pretty very high-ranking official in the railways, which is an important state-owned company in Russia. She's the kind of person who can make things happen. She's not, a Kremlin employee by any means, and she's not in some deep inner circle of President Putin's. But she's the kind of person who you could sort of count on to do something for you. She argues, and the man who helped set up the meeting, Emin Agalarov, that this was on her own initiative, that she was been lobbying for quite some time against American sanctions against Russia, and that she saw an opportunity to talk to the Trump people about that. And, you know, there is some plausibility to that, but it's also, I think, entirely possible that it's a little bit of a fishing expedition. Let's see what their opinion is about the sanctions. Let's see how interested they are in Hillary Clinton's emails, which, you know, which maybe she didn't have, but somebody in the Kremlin at that point had them. There are people who would say, you know, if the go-between the Russians and the Trump campaign was this British, madcap British publicist, Rob Goldstone, that doesn't sound like a well-oiled KGB operation. But then there are others who say, oh, no, he's a perfect foil, you know. He would allay all suspicion. So it's just totally fascinating.
And what are we to make of, for example, Ms. Veselnitskaya's denials that she has ever had anything to do with the Kremlin? Most people on this side of the pond at least take that with more than a modicum of credulity or incredulity. The fact that Mr. Goldstone, this, you know, sort of, as you say, madcap publicist, is, you know, taking this particular channel when Goldstone's client, this pop singer, his father knew Mr. Trump. It turns out that the client himself knew Mr. Trump. We even had yesterday a denial by this pop star that he even knew Goldstone, even though there's tape of them having dinner with Mr. Trump back in 2013. When we hear these denials from the Russians and these what clearly appear to be obfuscations to some extent by the Trump family, how do we sort this out? How do we make sense of who's telling the truth, who wants to tell the truth? I mean, when do we know to believe it or not to believe it?
Well, forgive me for laughing. That's a hard call, I got to say. And, you know, with Russia, let's say, just for instance, this is purely speculation on my part. Let's say that she went into the meeting to find out, someone had asked her to find out how interested are the Trump people in these Hillary Clinton emails and how interested would they be in lifting the sanctions against Russia. Let's just say that she was asked to do something like that.
Yeah, and that's certainly a plausible, plausible scenario, right?
Yeah, but we don't know.
But as you say, speculation.
She would not be putting a contract down on the table. You know, she would not even ask them directly either of those questions. It's all in, you know, inference and winks and, you know, hypotheticals, and with layers and layers of, you know, what they call plausible deniability behind it. She would not have been summoned to the Kremlin to talk to Vladimir Putin about this. She would not, I very much doubt, would have talked directly to Yuri Chaika, the prosecutor general, who some people have thought maybe was behind this. I'm a little skeptical of that. There would have been cutouts. There would have been go-betweens, and it all would have been very indirect and euphemistic.
You have a great piece in your paper today by Abby Phillips, writing in the Post. It posted last night that lays out a particular timeline. On the 7th of June last year, 2016, Mr. Trump announced that he was going to give a major speech in the coming days, and we're going to be discussing all of the things that have taken place with the Clintons, he said. And he says, I think you're going to find it very informative and very, very interesting. On that day, that's the day that Donald Trump Jr. Had emailed a confirmation of this meeting with Ms. Veselnitskaya, which was also to involve Paul Manafort, the campaign manager, and Jared Kushner, Mr. Trump's son-in-law, who's now a senior advisor. So that meeting took place on June 9th. The speech that Mr. Trump promised never took place. But does it seem plausible to you that the president or the candidate at that point was given word that this big meeting was going to take place and that he was going to have some opposition research to work with in a speech a few days later? Does that seem like a plausible scenario as well?
which he then, you know, according to this scenario, did not have, so he could not give that speech. plausible scenario, I would say, yes. Do we know that that's what happened? No. I mean, I think there are certainly other plausible scenarios, including even coincidence. But the way you spelled it out certainly fits with what we know.
Last week at the G20 summit, it was widely noted by the U.S. press and the international press that President Trump seemed somewhat isolated from his colleagues in the G20, that having to do with his decision to exit the Paris Climate Accord and other reasons, perhaps having to do with his rocky personal relationships with a few people. There's a lot of concentration, a lot of attention given, of course, to his meeting, which lasted a little more than 2 hours, with President Putin. He also met on the side with a few other G20 leaders. I wonder, given that, if he was a little bit isolated and if this America first and go it alone thing is actually translating into Trump himself going alone, what's the motivation for Emmanuel Macron to invite him to Paris for a state visit in the way that, for example, Theresa May has pointedly not done in London?
Well, my sense is that Macron is no fool, and France recognizes that the United States, under Trump or under any president, is a vital part of the network of countries that France belongs to, and that a Western Europe with a totally uninterested or disengaged United States, you know, would be facing enormous challenges. So he may have felt, watching Trump and Angela Merkel of Germany, who don't seem to get along at all, that, you know, it wouldn't be such a bad idea to play up to Mr. Trump a little bit. And I think Macron may have figured, I know how to deal with this kind of a person. You know, let's show him the big parade. Let's have lobster at the Eiffel Tower. He'll enjoy that, and he'll listen. And you know, he may be right.
If you've just joined us, I'm Tom Hall. This is a special edition of Midday. We are awaiting a press conference with President Donald Trump and President Emmanuel Macron of France. It was originally scheduled to begin at about 25 minutes after the hour. We're now told that it's been moved to 12:30, and we will see if they stick by that timetable. In the meantime, we are speaking with Will England. He is an editor on the foreign desk of the Washington Post. He's a winner of the Pulitzer Prize. He did three tours as a Moscow correspondent for both the Washington Post and the Baltimore Sun. His latest book is about Russia. It's called March 1917, On the Brink of War and Revolution. Here's a little bit of President Trump when he made an announcement about his decision to exit the Paris Accord.
We don't want other leaders and other countries laughing at us anymore, and they won't be. They won't be. I was elected to represent the citizens of Pittsburgh, not Paris.
So, Will, that's a big applause line in the Rose Garden of the White House, not so popular at the G20. A Pew Research Center poll was released a few days ago that said about only 14% of people in France say they have confidence in Trump, although it was as high as 59% saying that they supported the fact that President Macron had invited him. I mean, is there much political risk here for Macron, who is, like Mr. Trump, new on the job?
Well, let me also point out that the people of Pittsburgh didn't care for that remark too much.
Yeah,
either.
That's true.
If this visit just totally blows up in his face, that could be bad for Macron. His people did very, very well in parliamentary elections in June. He's popular in France right now. I think poll numbers that you read out suggest that the French people understand that, you know, however much you might have disdain for President Trump, it's better to talk to him than not to talk to him.
The fact that he has repeatedly dissed Paris, talked all about how crime-ridden it was and dangerous. He's got this mysterious friend, Jim, who's told him he's never going back to Paris again. I mean, we've got all these sort of funny stories about the city of love. But what does Macron have to deflect that? Does Macron have any agenda here that's meant to say, look, to his people domestically, look, this guy isn't so bad. I can, you know, we can work with him. We should be more engaging with him and welcoming it to him, even though he himself, at least during the campaign, was certainly not particularly considerate of us.
Well, I think Macron will say this sort of thing to the French people, but I think it's more a case of he and the French people are on the same side. I mean, they understand each other. I think people, of course, nobody liked in Paris. Nobody liked what Trump was saying, and nobody liked what his friend Jim had to say. But I think also nobody thought that Trump took that awfully seriously. You know, Trump is arriving, and the half the French army and an American regiment will be there to guard the streets of the Champs-Élysées. So he probably won't run into any trouble himself while he's there. You know, he says things. He says things that are emotive and that certainly are applause lines. I think nobody or very few people in France think that Trump himself would not ever want to go to Paris. You know, he's a guy who likes sophistication and of a certain sort, and you know, spectacle and beauty of a certain sort. You have the feeling that when he makes remarks like that, he's talking to an imaginary or perhaps not so imaginary audience in the heartland of America and not really tapping into his own deep thoughts.
And I believe, by the way, that I misspoke calling it the City of Love, although there's plenty of love going on in Paris. And if you walk across any bridge, you'll see all sorts of locks that indicate that. But I believe it's known as the City of Light.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about the meeting between President Putin and President Trump at the G20 summit. Now that the dust has settled a bit from that meeting, what do you think the big takeaways for the American government and the international community should be?
Well, of course, the most interesting thing right off the top is that they spoke for, what, almost 3 hours, far longer than had been planned. And it would be fascinating to know how that conversation went. We don't have very, I think, accurate reports because only Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, and Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, have talked about it. I think that the takeaway that Trump's opponents in this country got from the meeting was, well, I asked Putin if they had meddled with the American election, and Putin assured me they hadn't. Period. Of course, the White House
glad we settled that
differently.
Yeah,
right. Yes, right. if you can't freeze Putin out. If you can talk, of course, that's better than not talking. The question is a one-on-one, a bilateral, as they call it, a bilat. Is that going to shape the course of history, or do the two countries have larger establishments that kind of are stay on track in a sense? And I think it's the latter.
How much do you make of these personal relationships between leaders of countries? I mean, much was made of the very bad relationship, for example, that President Obama had with President Putin or Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel. People are saying that, Trump and Macron got off to kind of a rocky start where Macron sort of gripped his hand and wouldn't let go as if he were arm wrestling with him for a while. But that Macron was well aware and conscious of what he was doing, saying, I had to show them that we come to the United States from a position of strength. But now it seems that they're much more affable. They've had a few phone calls where things have gone well, and I guess they chatted themselves up a little bit at the G20 last week. I mean, how much are these personal dynamics between these leaders really important in the big scheme of things, given the fact that international geopolitics are influenced by a whole number of different factors?
Well, they're not meaningless, but I think we make too much of them. Personal relationships with leaders of countries like Russia or China or perhaps now the Philippines are more important than personal relationships with democracies like France or Britain or Germany, because in that first group of countries that I was talking about, the guy at the top really does more or less direct things. That's not so true in an established democratic or Republican government. Politicians. Trump may not be a politician, but virtually everybody he deals with is a politician, and politicians are like countries in that they don't have friends, they have interests. And if it's in their interest to deal with Trump, they will, however much they may not have a personal chemistry. And if they have a personal chemistry but it's not really in their interest to go along, then they'll pay attention to their interest.
Office of President Macron in the Élysée Palace has said that on the agenda this afternoon with Mr. Trump were things like Syria and what to do about that horrifying situation there, as well as the Paris Climate Accords. What do you expect Mr. Macron will have to say about that, and can you speculate as to what Mr. Trump's response might be, for example, when it comes to Syria and cooperation with the Russians or, trying to find a different tack when it comes to that very difficult dilemma?
Well, I'm sure one thing he'll want to do is hear from Trump what he and Putin talked about in regard to Syria. You know, we have this ceasefire that the Americans and Russians agreed to in the two provinces, and it went into effect last week, the beginning of this week, I guess. And it seems to perhaps be holding. Macron will want to find out, for one thing, what the conversation was, what the plan is, and then I think he'll want to talk about ways to try to expand on that. One thing to recall is that in the years after World War I, Syria was a French protectorate. So there is an old French interest there.
Will England is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and one of the foreign editors at the Washington Post. He directs the Post's Russia coverage. We are awaiting the beginning of a press conference with President Trump and President Emmanuel Macron of France that will take place in Paris. NPR will bring you live coverage of that event. It was scheduled to begin at 12:25. They are running a little bit late. We are at this juncture do not know exactly when it will start, but we do expect that it will be starting soon. Will England, by the way, is also the author of a book on Russia called March 1917, On the Brink of War and Revolution. So, Will, you talk about the history of France and Syria. History also plays into the dynamics of geopolitical relationships, and there is a longstanding history of American cooperation with France. Despite Mr. Trump's rhetoric about France, he even said at one point, France is no longer France. They won't like me for saying it, but, look what happened in Nice. Look what happened to that priest who was killed by apparently ISIS sympathizers. This was last summer during the campaign. Despite those kinds of comments, how much does the history of Franco-U.S. relations help move the ball forward when it comes to, bilateral cooperation in places like Syria?
Well, that history is something that people always like to trot out when we're trying to make the idea, promote the idea that the U.S. and France are getting along on something. The more recent history, going back to the beginnings of the war in Iraq, when the George W. Bush administration was extremely hostile to France, and we had freedom fries in the House of Representatives cafeteria and that sort of thing. So it's a history that's gone up and down. But yes, certainly it's very easy to tap into French support for the American Revolution, French-American alliance in World War I, our de facto alliance with the Free French and the Resistance in World War II, and France as a bulwark of the European Union, which the United or the, its predecessor organization, which the United States very much supported. And although France has for many years was rather standoffish about NATO, it still is one of the absolute key elements of the NATO alliance.
We actually have a clip of the president talking about France during the campaign last summer.
France is no longer France. They won't like me for saying that, but you see what happened in Nice. You see what happened yesterday with the priest who was supposed to be a spectacular man. France is no longer France.
So the French president is no longer the normal French president either. He's 39 years old, the youngest leader of France since Napoleon. And his style, his political style, is somewhat akin to Donald Trump's, is it not? I mean, they're both kind of brash, kind of out there. On the other hand, Mr. Macron sort of tamped down a nationalist movement in France. He beat in an election Marine Le Pen, who was, as the election drew near, people were saying that she could have pulled out. It was very possible that she would have pulled out an upset. The results of the election did not go that way. But, I mean, I wonder, is the fact that these two guys have their similarities in style as well as, very deep-seated differences in political philosophy or political policy, how much does that, affect the dynamic of their meeting this week and their relationship going forward?
I think it explains why they're able to get along after that rocky start. I think a guy like Trump probably would have gritted his teeth a little bit with that famous handshake with Macron, but afterwards he probably thought, okay, I can respect this guy, Macron, it's interesting, there was sort of Marine Le Pen was as you say, was, playing, running on this nationalist campaign, very nationalist campaign. But Macron was able to benefit from this different sort of populist feeling in France against the establishment, against the established parties, even though he had kind of come from the establishment. But he was a new face, and the Le Pens are both Marine and her father are not new faces in France. And so in that sense, he does, there is a similarity between him and Trump. He doesn't have that sort of make, France first, make France great again aspect to it, however. He has worried people in France by calling this week for a permanent imposition of a state of emergency, which would give him, more powers than he would normally have under the French Constitution. This sounds like something that Trump might wish he could do, but our Constitution doesn't allow for that. I think that Trump likes he likes guys with a certain kind of swagger, and which would describe Duterte in the Philippines and Abe in Japan and Putin in Russia, although Putin is very reserved, really, but he has a reserved swagger. And I think it would perhaps describe Macron as well, and it might explain why he doesn't like Merkel and perhaps why he's not that keen on going to Britain to see Theresa May.
Do you, as others have done, subscribe to the notion that perhaps Emmanuel Macron is the kind of heir to Angela Merkel in terms of leadership of the EU, that people see him as a rising star, not just in France, and obviously he's risen to the top of the heap politically in that country, but for the EU writ large. I mean, is Macron positioned to be even more influential and more significant in the years to come?
Well, we have German elections coming up, and so that will be the real test of Merkel's position. And I think things will be a lot clearer after they're over. If she doesn't do so well, then I think absolutely you're right, yes. Macron would be the person to kind of inherit the leader of Europe mantle.
Talk a little bit about the Paris Climate Accord. Of course, it was called that because it was signed in Paris. Here's Macron, who along with Putin and Abe and the rest of the G20, Merkel and Germany, all support the Paris Climate Accord and were very disconcerted and upset and opposed to President Trump's decision to withdraw the United States from that, the voluntary strictures of that agreement. We're told by the folks in Macron's office that he will bring this up with President Trump when they meet today. Is there anything that Mr. Trump can do to appease Macron today? Is there something that can come out of that meeting? Is there something that we might learn in the press conference that will be happening at some point in the near future, we hope? Is there something we could learn that would be something that Macron could point to say, there, I have this concession, or there, we've made a little progress, or there, you see, Mr. Trump isn't as stridently against this accord as perhaps he once seemed. What do you think Macron would be looking for as a takeaway from the meeting when it comes specifically to the Paris Climate Accord?
Well, I may be proved wrong in the next few minutes. I would not expect them to come out and to this press conference and announce some new American policy or concession or shift in gears. I think it's more a Macron lobbying campaign, you know, over the long run. And the thing to remember about the Paris Accord, as you pointed out, it was a voluntary set of voluntary goals and policies that the countries committed to follow, but it had no legal effect. And there's nothing that would prevent the United States from quietly but effectively adhering to the Paris Accord if it chose to. And I'm not saying that's going to happen, but you have many states and some cities, California, of course, is most prominent among them, talking about, you know, we're going to voluntarily follow the guidelines of the Paris Accord here in our state, whatever happens in the rest of the country. You know, Trump makes a big deal about coal and how we're going to make coal great again. We're going to make coal miners great again. But, you know, coal does not have a economic future, really. There are, you know, everybody likes this line about there are fewer coal miners than there are employees of Arby's at this point. And natural gas, because of fracking, is cheaper than coal. And as it happens, it's also cleaner than coal. So you can make a big fuss about coal, but you're probably not going to be creating a whole lot of new air pollution because of that fuss.
We have just gotten word that President Trump and President Macron have walked out to the site of the press conference in Paris, and we will be picking up NPR's live coverage of that press conference in just a little bit. Will England from The Washington Post, we want to thank you, sir. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it, and we look forward to our next time.
You betcha.
Will England is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He's the foreign editor at The Washington Post. He directs the Post's Russia coverage. He's also the author of a book on Russia called March 1917, On the Brink of War and Revolution. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, it's a special edition of Midday. We've just had a preview of the press conference between President Donald Trump and President Emmanuel Macron of France that is getting underway in just a minute or so from Paris, France. NPR will provide live coverage of the entire press conference that, as I said, is coming right up. We will, of course, have continuing coverage of the president's trip to France on All Things Considered tonight. He and his wife, along with Mr. and Mrs. Macron, will dine at the Eiffel Tower this evening, and he will attend the Bastille Day parade tomorrow on the Champs-Élysées and return to Washington tomorrow night. Earlier today, the president visited Les Invalides, which is the place that Napoleon's tomb is ensconced. So now we are going to NPR's live coverage of the press conference in Paris with President Trump and President Macron.